This is Jack Coggles, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 28th of January 2013. Jack Coggles, Part 1.
Alfred Batson Coggles.
Batson?
Batson, that's my middle name.
B-A-T-S-O-N. But you're known as...
Jack.
And where and when were you born?
I was born on March the 26th, 1920 in Rochester, Kent.
Okay, so you're now 92.
Yeah, I'll be 93 in March.
Okay. Would you say your dad was an educated man?
Not highly educated. He was well read. He introduced me to a lot of books, authors. I mean, he liked Dickens. He liked Dumas as well. And Somerset Maugham and people like that. He had lots of books at home, and this was a big introduction to me to read. And so,
was he interested in aviation?
No.
Was there any aviation?
Only a little. He was in the army right through the First World War. He was in the Royal Army Service Corps. He used to drive a horse ambulance around the front. And there were quite some stories he used to tell me about those, or yeah. Tell the family, yeah. Not gruesome stories, funny stories, really.
Can you remember one?
Well, there was one that wasn't... It was particularly the family. He had gone to the... taken somebody to the dressing station in the front line, and he found his brother-in-law there. That was my mother's brother, who was in the Gloucester Regiment. He'd been wounded. And he wrote a letter to my mother telling him that Arthur was wounded, was in the dressing station. And my mother got that letter before the army told his mother, you know, her mother. So, which was quite remarkable, really, that they could communicate as quick as that.
What was your dad's profession then, Jack?
He wasn't very highly professional. He worked... Well, he was in the army, and I think... For a time, he was a groom, because he got to know horses and use of horses very well. And he was a groom to a doctor in Rochester for a while. I don't know how long that went on for, but I know that when I was a boy, he used to work for Pickford's, you know, the delivery people. So he worked hard, but he'd got no basic... profession, really.
What about your own education? Where did you go?
Well, I passed a scholarship to the technical school, the junior technical school in Rochester. That was a 3-year course, and it was quite technical because we not only did we do the normal physics, chemistry, and mechanics. Normal things like history and geography and English, and we also did carpentry and metalwork. We had a metal shop there. It got a machine shop and also forge for forging tools. And we used to forge our own machine tools for the lathe when we got onto the machines. So it was quite a good, highly technical school. And it wasn't so many years after somebody told me why it was like that, because it was a cram school for the Chatham Dockyard. So I thought, well, that's possibly true. Anyway, it was a good technical basis for me. How I got into the RAF? Well... I'd always been interested in aircraft. I used to go round to Schultz, which was at Rochester on the river, and to watch them launch flying boats and seaplanes there. And I thought that was really wonderful to see that and everything. And when it came to me leaving school, I had quite a few offers. Post office telephones used to come round in your final term to recruit people, and also Shorts did as well. I wasn't too interested in either of those, really, not in factories. But my elder brother, came up with the idea. He said, there is a scheme in the RAF where they go in for 3 years as an apprentice to take an exam. So I took that exam from school. I remember I was the only one in the classroom taking it, sitting there all alone.
How old would you be?
How old would I be?
15?
15.
Yeah, yeah. And you passed, I presume?
I passed that, yeah. So I went to Horton for 3 years again, another 3 years, which was good.
So Horton, they were teaching you workshop skills or no, more than that?
Workshop and aircraft. Aircraft and engines, we used to do both. And a question of, on a photograph on the wall of a 504K, and that was the sort of aircraft they started us off on to take it to pieces and build it up again. And it was the same with engines as well, aircraft engine, all sorts of aircraft engines and associated, and the equipment that associated with the aeroplanes. So I went to Horton for 3 years. It was quite tough, really, but I met some nice... It's amazing, you see, I was meeting people from all over the country that I'd never known before, or people from that part of the north, south. I'd always been stuck in Kent
It's a long time ago, Jack, but would you say that aircraft technology was making great strides in those pre-war years?
It was, yes.
Can you give an example?
Well, hydraulic systems was one of the things. The aircraft we were actually trained on hadn't got hydraulic systems as we know it to now. Until the very end, part of the advanced course was at the end, going through an introduction to these hydraulic systems. But yes, and also the high speed monoplanes, single engines, monoplanes and things, which most of the aircraft that we were trained on were biplanes, I can't forget the names of them now.
And at what point do you think they started thinking about the Second World War? Were they designing and introducing planes in the late 30s with the war in mind?
The Spitfire was, and the Hurricane was being developed then.
And you saw that happening, did you?
Yeah, and the Battle as well, which was a very heavy... all-metal monoplane that was used at the beginning of the war. And, of course, the Blenheim twin-engine bomber came out. As a matter of fact, when I passed out from Horton, that was the first aircraft I was on. The squadron had just been re-equipped with Blenheims from... They'd had Orker Hearts and... I was posted to East Church, which was quite near me.
There was a sense that there might be a war?
Oh, yeah. Because when was the Austrian? When did the... Chamberlain go to, was it Chamberlain?
Yes, but it was in early 1939, wasn't it?
39, yeah, well, there we are.
I think.
Just after I passed out.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a feeling about it.
Did you spend any time abroad in those 6 years of World War Two?
Yeah, I was in Iceland. I was in on a Norwegian Marine squadron. There was five RAF NCOs there, I suppose, on an advisory capacity more than anything else. And that was in Iceland. Not that what you call Iceland wasn't what you call a polar region, but it, well...
It was snowy.
A bit snowy there. And that was... we came back to... we got re-equipped with Sunderlands and we came back to Oban, which was quite good.
At what point did you become interested in the Antarctic then?
Oh, very late on, I think, when I first heard about Shackleton. And also, how did I get to know about Priestley?
Sir Raymond Priestley.
That was another one.
You knew him, did you?
No, I've met him.
You met him?
Yeah. I met him.
How did he strike you?
Extraordinary man. Especially he wrote his book about that, didn't he? That was a party that got forgotten, wasn't it?
The Northern Party.
Northern Party, yeah. I've also got a book down in there by Campbell, who was Scott's first lieutenant, wasn't he? For a mate. It's called The Wicked Mate, and he was in charge of the Northern Party. He lived in that cave.
How did you meet Priestley then? Why did you bump into him?
When I met Priestley was at the... when we went to Birmingham University for the briefing before we came down to the Antarctic.
So you already got the job by then?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, you had an admiration of Shackleton.
Yeah.
So you must have read about him.
Oh, I'd read about him, yeah. I read some of his books. I've got over there, I've got the original film. It's been remastered by Frank Hurley of Shackleton's expedition there, which I watched guardedly and don't want it disappearing.
So how come you ended up working with FIDS? What happened with Bass? This was 1965.
Well, it's... I've got a peculiar hand disease, and I was downgraded medically that I couldn't go to hot climates. And I didn't want to do a long tour, and it came out on orders that they were looking for aircraft engineers to go down to the Antarctic for this period of time. So I volunteered for it. It would be a short tour and I could go. And that's why I went.
But why did you volunteer?
Because I thought I'd like to go to the Antarctic, that's why. Because I was... The question of Shackleton and Scotland. I was interested in what I wanted to go. And I thought all the circumstances seemed to fit in with what I needed at that time. So that's why I volunteered to go.
You were in your 40s, weren't you?
I know.
45, I said?
45, yeah.
Did
well,
that...
if they wanted me... I went on this interview and what was his name? The personnel officer of Bass.
Bill Sloman?
Bill Sloman. And when I walked into the room for this interview, he said, "Crumbs, you look fit." So I thought, well, I'm in there.
So the process was that you volunteered within the RAF and then they put your name forward, yeah, but you still had to be interviewed by FIDS.
FIDS, yeah. But there was also an RAF officer there as well to make sure that I wasn't going to let them down, I suppose.
What do you remember of the interview? Do you remember anything much?
I remember, cause I knew Peter Weston.
Explain about that, please.
Well, he was an apprentice in the RAF, but I knew him after that. He was an entry or so after me, but I did meet him. He was down on at Locking on another course, and we were on the course together. And you know, and that was before he went on the Transatlantic. I'm talking about the 48s and 49s now. And he was 53, wasn't it, the
Transantarctic Expedition.
Yeah.
So he was on that, was he?
He was on that.
And you maintained contact after he came back?
No, I did not too much. I did meet him again in the RAF, yeah.
Was he a kind of inspiration, would you say?
I think so, yeah. If he can do it, so can I, sort of thing. Yeah.
So that helped, you reckon?
Oh, yes, that helped. That was talked. They asked me about that, and I did when I mentioned it, and they said, yes. I sort of struck something with them. And I'd also been on some previous, I think this may have helped as well. Some years previously, I wasn't picked for it. I was sort of the only bloke available to do it. Went in charge of a target sewing squadron for a specific exercise, and I had a party of tradesmen there to look after and to develop. And it seemed to go well. As a matter of fact, this the officer who was in charge of the target time wrote a letter to my CO saying what a splendid job I'd done looking after all these aircraft and keeping the men happy and over long hours of work, etc. And that was in my documents. So this was something they looked at and thought, well, that looks good. You know, small aircraft. Otter's not a very big aircraft. So these things added up to being selected. There was three of us down there for this interview, if I remember rightly. And I was one of us picked to go.
What was the reaction back home to our Jack going to the Antarctic?
Well, my wife was a bit... I'm not certain. She accepted it to a certain extent, but I'm not certain she was really certain about it all. The children... that sounds great, Dad, you know. they weren't all that old and... my eldest son thought, I might be able to pull a few strings and get, because he used to work for a bank, and get transferred back to Chippenham somewhere for compassionate reasons. I suppose that was in his mind. But the rest of them thought it was good. Well, I had to write letters to my youngest daughter to be read out at school. This was something I did.
When you were down there?
When I was down there, you have to write her letters. Explaining it all about this.
So you were a bit of a celebrity, were you?
Well, I don't know.
So had you consulted Nora, your wife, before you went for the interview?
Yeah. She said, do you really want to go? So I said, yeah, it'll be a short tour. And it'll be an overseas tour, but it's finished with and done with. Then we can settle down till I retire. So she says, all right, but...
You retired just 10 years later, didn't you?
75,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
What preparation do you think was, Jack, when you got the job? And I expect there were a few months between doing the interview and heading south. What preparation was that?
I thought I'd better get myself fit. I went potato picking to toughen myself up over a holiday, which was rough. It was worse than being in the Antarctic, I think. But I didn't do really too much of it. But
how did you get to the Antarctic? What ship were you on?
Shackleton.
Oh, it was the Shackleton. With Frosty Turnbull.
Exactly.
Did you meet him?
Yes. He didn't mind me.
He didn't mind you?
No, I don't think he did. I remember being on the stern with him one day, and he was, and you know, we used to take, during the day, we used to take turns and go to steer the boat. And he was standing there at the turn, looking at the wake that was all wiggly like this, where they hadn't kept the boat straight. And he said, oh, God, I don't know. Why do I put up with this?
So you were being allowed to take the helm?
Yeah.
In the middle of nowhere, I presume?
Yeah, well, certainly not in a dock. And we used to do other research, like taking readings and things. And
how do you mean, Jack?
Well, I'm trying to think of what, such a long time ago, what it was something to do with the magnetic field of the seabed and the depths of the ocean. I can't remember what we actually did there, such a long time ago. It's no good me thinking about it because I can't remember what we did. I hadn't thought about that for a long, long time.
It sounds like you were doing soundings.
Possibly, yeah.
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 So they were doing research on the ship as it went south?
Yeah.
And you were called upon to...
to help.
...lend a hand on that?
Yeah.
Yeah. How was it sailing? Being an RAF man, did you mind sailing?
No, not at all. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think it was good. We did all the usual things. Holy stone to decks and things like that, which sailors do, don't they? It was all right.
You sailed to Montevideo?
From Portsmouth to, Southampton, was it? Southampton to Montevideo. Then we went to ashore. I remember going ashore. And going in the shops, and didn't buy much. Listening to all the political messages coming over the over the loudspeakers along the street, and more interested in picking up mail as well and posting it. As there. Yeah. I don't know how long we were there, a couple of days maybe, that's about all. And then we went to Port Stanley. Met the Bass people. I met an RAF man there. He was with another chap, I can't think of his name now, was running the Falkland Isles Air Service.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was a couple of beavers on floats they were using, and he was a Hex Alton boy, and he had been at Stonington.
Well, this had been John Huckle?
No, it's a Welsh bloke, and I can't think of his name now.
Alright.
He was there, and they had the Oster, and who was the base leader? giving.
I can look it up later on. Which base are you talking about?
Stonington.
In 65?
No, this would be before. This would be about 48.
48?
Yeah. Was it Kevin Walters or something?
Well, Kevin Walton.
Walton. Kevin yeah. Walton. He wrote a book, 2 Years in the Antarctic. That's I right. read it. And it was at the same time as Finn Ronnie was there from the American, and Jenny Darlington and his, the story of Jenny Darlington.
So you met Kevin Walton in Stanley? Is that what
no,
you said?
No, I didn't. That was, I met the... Kevin Walton was the bass leader at Stonington at the time, but I can't remember the name of this man. He was a Welshman.
Who was with Kevin Walton?
He was with Kevin Walton.
In 1948.
I think he was servicing the Oster there at the time.
H.D. Jones.
Jones is right.
Sounds Welsh, doesn't it?
Yeah, he was.
Flight Sergeant H.D. Jones.
That's right. He was running the Falkland Islands Air Service, and I had a word with him. Yeah, which was quite good, good introduction to it.
You also, I think, met the radio officer, didn't you, who you were going to communicate with later?
Yeah.
Did he go to Stanley Radio?
We did, yeah. I can't remember people's names.
Don't worry.
Oh, well, we met a lot of people there.
I'm interested in the fact that you went to the cathedral to a memorial service.
Yeah, there'd been these two men who'd gone down a crevasse with their sledges and dogs. This was a memorial service for them, which I thought was a good introduction to the Antarctic.
It didn't put you off?
It might have put my wife off when she read about them going down the crevasses. Because that would have come back on the papers and BBC News, wouldn't it? Because this happened as we were going out, when we were on the boat going out, that they had this terrible accident. But when we got there, there was a memorial service and we all went to it.
Do you remember their names?
I don't.
Do you know what base they were from?
It must have been Stonington, wasn't it?
I should know this, Jack. In 65, was it? I have to look this up later on.
I can't remember their names. No. As a matter of fact, it wouldn't have meant much to me going out their names like that, because I didn't know anybody out there at the time, did yeah. I?
But was it a somber? It must have been a somber occasion.
Yeah, it was a somber occasion. I mean, I think hearing this on the boat going down does bring you back to the life as it is and the dangers that could be. Yeah.
And then he set off. I think you went round quite a few bases before you ended up at Adelaide Island, which was your posting, wasn't it?
Well, Deception is the would be the winter base for the air party, because you can't park an aircraft at Adelaide. We would have give you the procedure. We went to Deception first of all on the Shackleton, and then the Shackleton couldn't go any farther south than Deception because it wasn't strong enough. And we stayed there until the Biscoe, and then we went down in the Biscoe to Adelaide. And this is where we went to Stonington to help unload at Stonington. And and then down to Adelaide, and we stayed at Adelaide. There was the next thing that would be when to bring the aircraft back to Deception for the winter.
So you met the Otter at Adelaide?
At Adelaide, yeah.
Yeah. On the way down, you had some bad news.
My father died. Yeah. That would have been 66, wouldn't it?
Early 66.
Early 66.
Yeah.
Because I'd had Christmas at Deception. It's... There's nothing much I could do about it, unfortunately. I couldn't get back then. It was impossible. So I did send a signal. I got help with that.
The RAF helped you send a message home?
No, the Bastid.
Bastid. A telex or a telegram?
Yeah.
Telegram. Yeah.
They'd got those series of where you could pick what you wanted to say. You know, they're all already on a list there. You picked out what you want.
So they had some suggested messages, did they?
That's right, yeah.
And you just
they used to use that during the war as well, didn't they?
Did they?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember what they called them now. But...
So you didn't write your own telegram, you just selected from a list?
Selected one to be sent.
On behalf of you?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're getting out of sync here, I think. You arrived at Deception, and then from Deception you went down to Adelaide, and that's where you met the aircraft.
That's right.
In the summer.
In the summer.
Yeah. What was your first impression of this single-engine Otter? When you've been working on Spitfires and bombers?
Well, for me, it was another aircraft. It had got main planes and a rudder. And controls and an undercarriage. Didn't retract, of course, but it was an undercarriage. The only addition, it got skis on it. And there was a lot of ice there. And, the ice used to build up there. And, of course, if the aircraft wasn't used for days, snow would freeze and you've got to get it everything free. But looking out, it was quite impressive to stand there and look out over Margaret Bay and see all these icebergs there. And there was that thing I wrote, put it in the where I saw these penguins coming over the ice. Going to Avian Island, to the rookery there, yeah. That was quite a sight, really. I hadn't got a camera with me, unfortunately. It would have been a big help.
Yeah. Well, was the Otter in good condition?
Not really, but it was serviceable. It was aging. Course, and it was a similar. I suppose it was the same engine, but the engine was quite serviceable.
What was it being used for?
Well, it's like a Carter Patterson, isn't it? It's used to transport. For one thing, visiting the sledging teams was the main purpose of the. To help them in the field, to take fuel and dog food and man food, and lay bases for them where they wanted to go. I mean, we went out to the Wordy Ice. Of course, this is after the we're jumping time there, aren't we? We went out to the Wordy Ice shaft itself. For the two teams that were there, and I know Bob went on reconnaissance, took them on reconnaissance to see where they could go next.
Bob Burgess,
The
pilot. Yeah.
and to lay there and put on the aircraft. There was a fuel drum and dog meat, lots of dog meat, and man food, and that was all loaded, unloaded, and stacked there with a pole over the top with a flag. This was a major task of those. And also any emergency that might crop up that had to be done.
Were you ferrying dogs in the plane as well?
They used to, apparently. We never did.
You didn't? Did. No.
But that could happen.
Did you ever get into the pilot's seat?
No.
No.
Oh, yes, I must have done when servicing.
No, not flying. You didn't fly.
No.
But you were co-pilot.
Well, I used to sit with Bob. Mostly I used to feed him. Sandwiches. So.
Were they good for the job? Was it good for the job, the little otter?
Yeah. It was a good job. Did that job well.
What were the things that went wrong on it? What were you most having to do with it?
Sparking plugs needed changing at times. We had damage to a wingtip once with a deception where the terrific gale caught it, and the picketing points at deception weren't all that great for tying the aircraft down, not at that time. But the wingtip did hit the ground, and we had to change that wingtip. I remember that.
So how were the... I know we are jumping around, but it doesn't matter. At deception, when the plane was being anchored, how was that done?
It's on screw pickets. Now, I'm going to jump now again, but after I'd built the Philotas Porter, I'd got some time to spare, and I thought, well, those picketing points for the aircraft are not very good. I think if the base leader let me have some of the cement, because that's another thing in short supply, I could dig out all the earth that was there. Actually, it was what they used to call volcano dust. Dig that out, screw in some screw pickets and pour some cement in and make major holding down points for both the aircraft, I thought then. Mm. But the Philotas Porter didn't come back. I think that's another story.
We'll come to that later. Yeah.
So I did those while I got some spare time after the aircraft was built.
And that improved things?
Well, it would have done, but it was the following year. Well, that's another story. When it blew up, didn't it, the island?
The eruption.
So that was the end of everything there for the time being.
So there was just before you built the second plane, you only had one?
You only had one.
Adelaide, the one twin otter.
One twin otter, yeah.
And they were quite happy to operate that plane without a backup plane, were they?
Well, there's nothing else they could do, was there?
And there were two fitters, yourself and a colleague?
No, yeah, Roy Brand. I don't know if you've met him.
Roy Brown?
Brand.
Brand, okay. No, I haven't.
No. But,
was the otter ever grounded because of mechanical problems?
Well, they grounded it when it came back from Adelaide. They thought it was getting a bit old and had metal fatigue, which I think is... You see, it did, even getting the aircraft away from the ground was quite a strain on the aircraft, because Bob had to waggle the controls to break the ice on the skis and the wheels, and that must have been quite a strain on the aircraft.
So it was frozen to the ground?
Yeah. Yeah, to the structure. so it never flew. But then, of course, the Deception Island blew up as well.
Yeah. Let's just talk a bit more about Adelaide, if we might.
Yeah.
If we can. What sort of accommodation were you in? Where were you living?
In a hut. We did spend a lot of time sleeping in the radio hut to be near the radio, because all the requests used to come through on the radio from the bases, from the dog teams, that they and Bob used to work out his route, and Roy and I would get the aircraft loaded with fuel and everything.
So you were handy for the scramble.
Was it just a scramble, yeah? And we used to get a cake from the cook for the boys in the field. And
precious cargo.
And sandwiches for us on the way, because that was okay.
So when you were visiting field parties, you were landing on the straight snow, presumably.
Yeah.
Did you have regular landing spots, or would you just land anywhere you felt like?
Well, we didn't often go. The way things were, what happened is they only made two trips to the field, and a lot of the boys on the base there thought they'd like to go out as well. And so Bob said, well, you know, I better take one out there. So after that first time when I went, somebody else went the next time from the base just for experience. But then things changed, and we had to go and pick up this man from Argentina and take him back to Deception. So that sort of phase of the works halted, because we were going to be away. Because if you go on one of these, you've got to wait for the weather to come back. You know, this is the way it was. Weather was it so important?
Well, let's talk about that then, because there was a man on the Argentine island base who had a perforated ulcer.
Right.
Was he a British man or an Argentinian?
British. Well, Argentine Islands is a British base. Yeah. They just call it the Argentine Islands.
It's confusing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So tell me that story from the beginning. What was the first news you got of this?
Oh, from Port Stanley, telling us that efforts must be made to get him and take him back to Deception, okay, where the Shackleton could take him to Punta Arenas. So then this was decided we'd do this. But we had to wait for suitable weather then to go, which we did. And then when you get to the Argentine Islands, you've got to wait for suitable weather to go on. And we couldn't land at the base. It was unsuitable. We had to land on the sea ice, which was, I don't quite know how far it was away, but it seemed an awful long way to me. About, if I said 2 miles, I might be exaggerating, I don't know.
2 miles from the landing to the base, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we would, and I wasn't too happy about the fact we got no way, decent way to secure the aircraft to the ground. We used to carry these 5-ply wood, about 18 inches square, with a nylon rope attached to it, to tie down the two main planes and the tail unit. And these used to be dug into the snow and packed up with the snow for the snow to freeze. I wasn't too happy, but what could you do under the circumstances? You're on sea ice. Isn't it as if you could drill a hole through the sea ice and put an anchor in there? So we just hoped that the weather would keep calm and that would hold. And of course, we went to the base then, but we were going to wait for weather to change. And I can't remember how long we were there. It was a good number of days. And then we got the had a weather forecast that was good. And we went back to the aircraft, got it ready, and they brought the man out in, on a sledge. And we secured him in the fuselage. There was no release. And he was quite warm and safe, and I'm going to keep my eye on him while we're flying. So then we flew up.
There's no doctor with him?
No doctor.
No.
The doctors, I might be putting myself in trouble here. The doctor was there for the dogs, really. There was a doctor at Stonington. He was the only doctor.
So you flew the patient to Deception?
To Deception. And then he was taken. The boys came out on the sledge and took him back and got him into a nice bed and waited for the shackle to come. Then Bob and I would wait for decent weather to get back again. But this is all time that's gone where we weren't working in the field, you see.
Mm.
And then when we did get back, it's this other emergency arose. This would be, it was, I don't think I've mentioned this, about Anvers Island, which is an American base. The Biscoe was bringing out Dr. Charles Swithinbank. And he'd got this ice measuring machine to measure the depth of ice, and he was bringing it out to fit it on the otter to measure the depth of ice over the peninsula.
From the air?
From the air.
So like a radar equipment?
Radar equipment that he'd devised, I presume. And we were going to go up to Anvers and wait for the Biscoe to come in, because that's as far south as it could get at the time. And at the same time, from Adelaide, a sledging team was going to sledge up Adelaide Island to the top. And the idea was to unload all the goodies that the boys at the base wanted from the ship they'd ordered. And we were transported over from when the ship came in. So the ship came in, and aboard, what of course would have been the relief pilot coming out, and also the mechanics that were coming out. And John Ayers, the pilot for the Pilatus Porter. Well, that was the general idea, and that was explained to me before we left Adelaide to go up to Anvers, that I wouldn't be coming back because I would have to go up and build the Pilatus Porter, which I thought, well, was something different. So that was all right. And aboard that, there was an army sergeant, and I can't remember his name, who was going to work with me on the Pilatus Porter. So all this was brought off the Biscoe, and with Charles Swithinbank, and the idea then was to fly. But there is one or two stories about the Americans there. They'd only ever seen one Englishman, and he was a scientific officer on Anvers Island with the Americans, and all their idea and they were dreading us coming because they thought, well, I hate to say this, that we were all like him, because because one of the Americans said to me after about a couple of days, he said, "I'm sorry, we seem so cold, but we'd only ever met Ross." Well, I can't remember his name, so it doesn't really matter. But he wasn't a very nice man at all. So
they presumed all Limeys were
like that.
Difficult.
Yeah.
Were you leading up to a story? You said that you, when you went to Anvers Island, there was a problem there. No? Well, have I got that wrong?
That was the problem.
The one Englishman?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
But they were all right. After a while, they had plenty of food. I almost forgot to admit that.
Their fridges were stuffed, were they?
Yeah. I asked them, I said, "How do you solve things out?" They said, "Well, we just go through these spare ribs until we come to the steaks." I thought, there's us living off tin food. And...
Which summer was it that you built the Porter's Porter? The first or second summer?
Second summer.
Okay, so I'll come back to that shortly. In the meantime, as winter descended upon the Antarctic in your first winter, your one winter, in your first summer, you were then transported, you then took the plane back to Deception Island.
Yeah, we have been getting mixed up with timing, haven't we?
It's all right, we can work that later. But so that the winter, that first, that one winter you were down south, you actually spent at Deception Island.
Yeah.
With the otter.
The otter was in service and it was in the hangar.
Right, so you were working in the hangar, were you? You were doing the repairs and the servicing in the hangar.
In the hangar.
Yeah. But it was still rather cold, I would have thought.
It'd be cold because... I won't go into that just now. It was cold, yeah. And there was nothing much we could do after a while. The engines had been inhibited and serviced, and that was it. So there was a bit of time to spare.
How did you fill it?
Well, one of the Met men said to me, "Oh, we've got to do all the statistics of the weather. We dread that." So I thought, that's not so bad. I said, "I'll do it for you." Maths being something I'm always interested in. So I said, "Well, I'll do it. I'll do all the statistics." The only interesting one was the wind, because that was quite a lot of wind and varying wind and speeds and directions. The rest of it, like precipitation, interesting. Sunshine? No, wasn't any. So I did all that for them. I'm not certain that Bob agreed that I should do it. But I thought, well, I'd have better than that. It's something being done positively. And eventually I started doing observations with them for them as well. I took my turn of going out at night and checking all the readings in the screen. So that was another thing I did.
And that was because otherwise there was nothing for you to do?
No, except internal painting. They'd built a new fibreglass quarters that was attached to the old whaling station, and that had to be painted. And so there was always that to do.
Was that a significant improvement over the previous
one? Oh, yeah.
In what respect?
It was more comfortable and warmer as well, being fiberglass.
Mm. And yeah. Did you have your own private room? Or
you had your own room, yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how was the... Presumably you had to move into it at some point. Move all your things across from the old hut to the new one.
Yeah, well, it was connected.
Oh, they were connected?
They were connected, yeah. They still use some rooms in the other... The library and the bar were still in the old hut.
Mm.
Well, if you've seen the DVD, you've seen it.
Well, your Christmas meal was in the old hut and your midwinter meal was in the new hut.
That's right.
And you didn't have to wear, you were in your shirt sleeves on your midwinter meal.
I was, yeah. Yeah.
So it must have been quite warm inside there.
It was quite warm, yeah.
Fiberglass hat.
Yeah. Because we got fires. We had coal fires, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the DVD, you mentioned about dealing with scurvy or avoiding scurvy.
Ascorbic tablets, they were always on the table at meal times. Ascorbic tablets, yeah. We used to take those because we had no green vegetables, did we? At all.
And the photograph of the bar, the walls seemed to have strange objects pinned them.
Ties. Half ties that you requested to cut off a piece of your tie with your name on and pin it to the wall.
Do you know where that started?
Oh, that started a long time ago, right from the beginning. At one period of time, when would that have been? When Prince Philip was on the... he went on a tour around on the Britannia, and he called in at deception. That would have been in the 50s.
It was, yeah.
I just often wondered, did he leave a bit of tie? I don't think he did.
I think he did.
Did he?
I think there's a Prince Philip. I seem to remember reading there's a Prince Philip tie there, yeah.
Oh, I don't remember seeing it. Unless somebody had pinched it as a souvenir.
So you wintered at Deception Island. Mm. At what point would you then start thawing out the plane?
It would be in September, I would think. Or October. The first job then would be to get the hangar doors open because they'd be frozen. And it's no good putting antifreeze down there because it would just get diluted and freeze again, wouldn't it? So it's just a question of hard work, digging out the ice. It might take a couple of days to do that.
Yeah.
And then we got to get the aircraft out and fit the skis once we go, because you can't get the aircraft. You have to put the aircraft in sideways because of the wingspan. The hangars were built for beavers, which are the shortest wingspan. And you can't keep on rebuilding hangars when you change your aircraft. So and then you get the skis on, and ground test the engines.
Would you have drained the aircraft for the winter?
No.
No? So you had lots of very thick oil in there by the time you... Would it freeze up?
It didn't seem to make a lot of difference to the oil. I mean, because at Adelaide we kept all the fuel was outside on that plateau, roped together and frozen in, and so was the oil. Mm. So it didn't seem to have affected a great deal. I don't know why.
So there wasn't a great deal to do, really, to get it flying again?
No, but that's when we had the accident and we had to change the wingtip, which delayed us a bit. And I can't quite remember when we did go down there. It must have been October.
Back to Adelaide Island.
Back to Adelaide Island, yeah.
Yeah.
But then we had bad weather and we had to divert into Argentine Islands for some days as well. We may have taken us a week to get down there, if not more.
Hmm. I'm just going to pause for a minute and we'll change the disc.
Okay.
So let's just take a short break. And I'll put a fresh disc in.